This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Taking a look at the issues surrounding the health and well-being of our LGBTIQ+ communities. This is Well, 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 brought to you by the team from Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network.
You're listening to Well, Well, Well on Joy and the Community Radio Network. I'm your host, Cal Hawk, and here on Well, 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 we dive into the issues impacting and interwoven into the health and well-being of our LGBTIQ+ communities and people living with HIV. Well, Well, Well was recorded on the lands of the Boonwurrung people down here in St. Kilda at Joy Studios in the Victorian Pride Centre. On Well, 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 we do love to chat with doctors around an array of health topics, but with World AIDS Day just around the corner on the 1st of December, I'm talking to three generations of doctors involved in the response to HIV and AIDS over the years, asking each of them to reflect on their careers, personal experiences, and how far we've come 4 decades on in responding to HIV in this country. To kick things off, I've asked Dr. David Bradford back to the show. Longtime listeners may remember when we had David on from the VAC Legacy series about 5 years ago in the lead up to Thorn Harbour Health's 35th anniversary. Now, David's back in to talk about his experience after graduating from Sydney University in 1965, a brief stint in Vietnam, some time in London in the 1970s. He did move back to Australia and started to specialize in sexual health just as the epidemic of HIV and AIDS hits Australian shores. Now, Dave is going to be joining me here in the studio to talk about his trajectory into sexual health and his involvement in the early response to HIV and AIDS. That's all coming up here on this week's episode of Well, Well, Well.
You're getting Well, Well, Well with the team from Thorn Harbour Health.
You're listening to Well, Well, Well here on Joy and the Community Radio Network. I'm Cal Hawk, and now joining me in the studio is the one and only Dr. David Bradford. Welcome to the show, David, but I should actually say welcome back because we did talk to you about 5 years ago, I think around the 35th anniversary of Thorn Harbour Health and the Victorian AIDS Council. Thanks for coming back onto the show.
That's all right. It's a pleasure.
Can you tell listeners a little bit about the start in your career in medicine and how you got involved?
Well, my parents always wanted me to be a doctor and, you know, I was a pretty compliant son, so their wishes were complied with, and I graduated from Sydney University in 1965, and I was an intern at Concord Repatriation General Hospital in Sydney, and I guess that kind of shaped my early career, because I, at the end of 2 years as an intern, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. I thought I might want to specialise in surgery, but I wasn't absolutely sure. And because of the contacts, army contacts in the repatriation hospital, and because Vietnam had just started up and there was a need for young doctors in the Australian army to go to Vietnam, I thought that might be a good way of gaining experience, particularly surgical experience. And so I signed up in the army. And so I was in the army for the next 22 months, including a year in Vietnam.
Kind of a baptism of fire, really.
Yes, it was. I was kind of lucky in that it wasn't quite as bad a baptism of fire as it might have been. I was kind of lucky that the army, in their wisdom, decided I should be the doctor for a artillery regiment. And the artillery is always back a bit from the action. And so I spent the whole of that year looking after basically young men, all around average around the age of 20, 21, about 800 in all. And I was like really their GP. Of course, there were some injuries and there were a couple of nasty war wounds, but predominantly it was just being ordinary old mundane general practice.
And I mean, not to generalize, I guess, thinking Defense Force and military, but, you know, you do hear stories back in the day that, you know, when you were on tour, STIs and things like that. Is that kind of how you segued into sexual health?
It is indeed the way I got into sexual health. Because, as I said, it was like being a GP, but this was a GP for a select group, young men who were, by and large, cooped up in an army camp in Nui Dat, in the jungle, for a whole year. And the only times they got off was 5 days that they had for rest and recreation in the country, in a place called Vung Tau on the coast, and 5 days in a foreign capital, Bangkok, Manila, Hong Kong, and later on Sydney. And inevitably they behaved like young men always do, and they acquired sexually transmitted diseases. And so a very large part of my practice was looking after people who had sexually transmitted infections.
Wow. And I mean, I imagine a lot of this would fly under the radar, but at that point, were any of them gay?
Very little indication about it, because it wasn't a thing you talked about in right. the army. I certainly didn't talk about the fact that by that time I was pretty sure I was gay. I certainly didn't let on to anyone, even my closest friends in the army. And it was not surprising, therefore, that young private soldiers, or gunners, as my lot were called, would want to talk about it either. Fair enough. There were kind of little suspicions that you got as a doctor. Mm.
Okay, so you leave your time in the military, and where to next?
Well, then I went to England, because I decided it would be totally unacceptable to my family if I was to announce that I was going to become a specialist in sexually transmitted infections. It certainly wasn't looked upon with great favour in the medical profession either. So I decided I'd do what I'd originally thought and decide to specialise in surgery. So I went to England to do a course in surgery, in basic medical sciences, and then I worked in hospitals around London for the next nearly 3 years, and I got a couple of surgical degrees, and then I came home to Australia. Well, when I came home to Australia, I was on a long holiday of about 6 weeks. This was after I passed my surgical exams and before I went back to take a registrar job in surgery back in England. And when I was at home, several things happened that were kind of life-changing. One was that I came out to my parents. The other was that I met my partner, who I'm still with. And there were then all the complications of my having to go back to England and he still being here in Australia. And so for the next 8 months, we corresponded. We did those phone calls that lasted 3 minutes and all of that sort of stuff.
So what year is this?
This is 1973, 74.
Oh, right. Mm. Okay, so well and truly before any sort of Zoom, Skype, FaceTime.
Exactly. Okay. There was nothing like that at all. We used to make tapes. We both had little tape recorders, you know, those little, you know, tiny tape recorders. And we used to send tapes. You could get kind of pocket tapes that you could easily post and send back and forth.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so that's how we kept it up until I left Australia in January, and he came over to live with me in August.
Okay. Mm.
And we've been together ever since.
Oh, that, how long have you been together?
Well, 50 and a bit years.
That's remarkable. Mm. And congratulations to you both in that regard. That's no small feat, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. It was quite a feat. The first few months are the worst, because we'd only known each other for a very short period of time in Australia before I had to go back to England. And so we had to learn to live together, and that took a bit of doing, really.
Yeah. I think it takes a bit for anybody, really. Yeah. But 55 years later, that is remarkable. Coming back to your career, though, how do you eventually get back here, and how do you get involved in sexual health? Because you said there was a bit of stigma in the industry attached to being...
Oh, well, in the profession, there certainly was. Well, what happened was I decided I wasn't cut out for surgery. So I had a period in general practice in London before I came back to Australia. We both decided after living in London for, well, between 73 and 79, we decided we ought to come back to Australia. And so I came back to Australia, but before I came back, I had started renewing my interest in sexually transmitted infections by doing some part-time locum work in an STD clinic in London. And while I was doing that, I did a diploma in venereology, as it was called then, And so I came back to Australia equipped with those, and there was a job going at the Melbourne Sexual Health Centre, which was previously called the Melbourne Communicable Diseases Centre. And so I started there in early 1980.
Okay.
And the boss, the old director of the clinic, retired a few months later, and they suggested that I should apply for the job, and I got it. And so I became the director of the clinic.
And this was the one in the CBD, yeah?
Yes, it was in the CBD in Little Lonsdale Street. Yes.
And so you've stepped into this. It's the early 80s.
It's the early 80s, yes.
About a year later, I think the first AIDS reported case comes up in the New York Times.
June 1981.
Yeah. So when does it get onto your radar?
Well, it was published in a thing called the MMWR, which I can't remember what it stands for, but it was a monthly or bi-weekly, fortnightly publication from America that kind of detailed new developments in infectious diseases. It had a little article about the outbreak of Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis carinii pneumonia in June 1981. And someone in the health department, whose job was to look at these things, had crossed his desk, and he wrote a note on it saying, maybe, Bradford, you'd be interested in this, and sent it down to me. And that was the first I heard about it.
And at the time, did it just seem like a rare thing that wasn't going to become? I mean, did you have any sense that it was going to become?
Well, the number of cases that were detailed in that were... you know, concerning, I think you'd have to say. And certainly when you started to read the gay press from America, you realise that gay people in America were very concerned about it and what it might mean for the future. And so we started to get concerned back here in Australia. And from having to look after, you know, well-documented sexually transmitted infections like gonorrhea and syphilis and non-specific urethritis and chlamydia and so on, suddenly we were confronted with what might be a lethal sexually transmitted infection in that it resulted in AIDS and ultimately in death. So it was very, very concerning and not a little frightening, really, because there was so little known about it in the first few years.
Now, David, the community is starting to hear, they're getting quite alarmed around the emergence of, I mean, at that point, we were really talking about AIDS. And the ALSO Foundation organizes a community forum, I guess, if you will, in June of 1983. And you get whacked up on stage for that. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yes, I got whacked up on stage with some other doctors. There were a few gay doctors in Melbourne who had general practices, which were largely focused on providing good care for gay people. And those doctors were well known in the gay community, and so they and me and the registrar from the Royal Melbourne Hospital, who at the time in infectious diseases, who at the time was Dr. Ian Fraser, who subsequently became a professor and discovered the vaccine for HPV.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yes, he was on stage as well. How did I feel about it? What was the experience like for me? Well, the experience was that we were being asked questions that we didn't have the answers to. And that was frustrating. No doctor likes to be put on the spot and ask questions that he doesn't have the answer to. And we were meant to make sense. So we each contributed. We each had a little say. And then there were questions from the floor. And the questions mostly revolved around how do you not get this thing and what do you think causes it? And at that time, it wasn't even definite that it was caused by a virus. No one knew that. It was strongly suspected in many expert quarters, but it wasn't known. And there were all sorts of strange theories that it might be due to using too much amyl, and it might be due to too many sexual partners, because the initial papers from the United States went into details about the patients who had AIDS and who had died of AIDS, And one of the things they focused on, because I suppose it was sensational, was how many sexual partners these guys had had. And of course, like most gay men, they'd had lots of sexual partners. And so there was shock horror in the news reports about this. And it was suggested that if you had too many sexual partners, that it might overload your immune system. And therefore, it would crash. And that's why you were susceptible to these opportunistic infections and cancers.
Proven to have nothing to do with it.
It had nothing to do with it whatsoever. But it was a theory that many people kind of held on to for quite a while.
When is it that you have your first patient or client? What was that experience like when you go, I'm dealing with someone who's HIV positive or has an AIDS defining illness?
Right. Well, the first patient that we had in the clinic came in about towards the end of 1984. And this was a young man who had developed weight loss and a cough. And a cough that wouldn't go away. And he'd come in because he thought he needed to check up for sexually transmitted infections because he had had lots of casual, anonymous sexual encounters. And meantime, he was living out in the suburbs, in the eastern suburbs, with a very respectable family. He was a scout master. So he was looked up to in his local community. And yet, you know, he'd been doing the beats sometimes at night, and he'd and although we checked him out for sexually transmitted infections, we didn't at that stage have the HIV antibody test. However, I thought, having read about the symptoms of pneumocystis, that it was pretty definite that he might actually have that. And so I sent him out to Fairfield Hospital, and they admitted him. And sure enough, he did have PCP, and he was treated in the hospital. And then we followed him up at the clinic, quite regularly after that.
When that starts to happen, of course, that's just imagine one of the first of several patients.
It was.
When do you get a sense of, I guess, scale of the worst? I mean, did you see the worst of it coming? And, you know,
well, we did, you know, because once that we'd had that patient experience, me and my staff I'm talking about at the clinic, we started to realise that there were many other, particularly gay men, who were exhibiting not quite as florid symptoms as he'd had, but, for example, a guy I knew quite well who I'd first met when I was doing blood tests at Steamworks at the gay sauna in the CBD. He came along one day very, very terrified, and he said to me, "I'm really, really scared because I found this lesion on my leg." And when he showed it to me, I was scared too, because it was absolutely classical of the pictures that I'd seen of Kaposi's sarcoma. I'd never seen it, of course, in a patient, but I'd certainly seen a number of pictures in the press and in the medical journals that were coming out at that time. And so I sent him to Fairfield too to have it biopsied, and then following that, there was just a run of people who were obviously exhibiting symptoms. And around about that time, at the end of 1984, we first had the opportunity to do HIV antibody tests. They weren't officially available then, but this was an in-house test that had been developed at Fairfield by the virology department at Fairfield Hospital, and they offered it to us at the clinic.
Now, I'm mindful that, you know, I've obviously working in this space for a while, I'm familiar, but listeners who may not know, what is a Kaposi sarcoma? Because you mentioned pneumocystis pneumonia, people are familiar with pneumonia, roughly.
Yes.
What is KS?
Well, Kaposi sarcoma was a really rare cancer or tumor. It was largely seen in people, elderly gentlemen, you know, well, when I say elderly, probably 60 and over. Gentlemen of Mediterranean stock, and it didn't seem to happen in anyone else, and it causes these purpley spots on the skin, And in these elderly gentlemen that had been known about before, it was a very slowly developing cancer, and not of great, huge concern. Of course, they were treated with radiotherapy and so on to slow down its progress. But in these young men, it was quite a prolific cancer, and it spread not just in the skin, but it could occur on the mucous membranes, in the mouth, in the intestine, in the intestinal tract. And it could spread, metastasize to the lungs and ultimately be fatal. So it was a very, very unpleasant tumour in these immune-suppressed young men.
The medical community more broadly, I mean, you're obviously coming in with an empathy and a sympathy around the fact that you are a gay man yourself.
Yes.
But how do you think the medical community more broadly, did you observe... what were your reflections on that back in, I guess, the late 80s, early 90s?
Well, the medical community in general responded fairly poorly, I think. I think the main reason was that they, most of them weren't used to seeing gay patients. So they weren't really coming across it at all in their daily practices. There were certainly some who became aware early on, like dermatologists who had Kaposi's sarcoma referred to them. But by and large, mainstream medicine, it bypassed. And so I think the response was slow. And I think the prejudices that were around in the community about this gay disease applied to a large bulk of the medical profession too. There were notable exceptions, of course, but apart from the gay doctors or gay sympathetic doctors who were used to dealing with gay patients, I think on the whole the medical profession was in ignorance and didn't really want to know.
World AIDS Day is coming up at the end of this month. 4 decades on since yes. those first community meetings in 83, what are your reflections on our progress in that time?
Oh, well, I think our progress has been enormous. As far as both the management of HIV is concerned, the outlook for patients with HIV/AIDS, the community feeling about it, I think largely the stigma has dissipated. It's still there in some quarters, but by and large it's dissipated. And I think the fact that we have good preventions now, I mean, we had to depend on condoms. And selling condoms to young sexually active people is not easy. They understandably make excuses and try and not use them and forget to use them. But the fact that we've now got a drug that you can give and that someone can take daily and that can, 99% prevent you from acquiring HIV has made a tremendous difference, I think. And I think it means that the optimistic hope of actually eradicating HIV infection is well on the horizon.
What impact do you think it has had on you?
Well, I think it had, like any doctor who had to look after patients back in those bad old days before we had effective treatments, it had a huge impact. There were colleagues of mine who burnt out, understandably. I myself found that I really couldn't continue in the practice that I'd moved into after leaving the health department's STD clinic, because the patient load of HIV patients had got just too much. And that's really one of the main reasons why I left and went to work in Cairns, where the patient load wasn't nearly as high and where it could be shared around a bit more.
Speaking of personal reflections, not too long ago you also wrote a book. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Yes, I wrote a book. It's called Tell Me I'm Okay, and it's published by Monash University Publishing. And the reason I wrote it was I wanted it not to be forgotten what the early patients with HIV had gone through in those days. And so I chose the stories of about... I think there's about 7 or 8 patients that I've documented their stories and explained, what they went through and what their progress was. And the whole idea was really so that they wouldn't be forgotten and so their contribution wouldn't be forgotten, because many of these patients went on clinical trials where there was no real guarantee that it would benefit them at all, but that it might well benefit the rest of the community in the long run. And they did that willingly and, often went through, lots of, difficult times because of that. So I think that those were the reasons I wrote the book, so that those people wouldn't be forgotten.
Well, look, I did read the book when it came out, and it's been a few years ago now, but it is an excellent read, and it touches on a lot of the stuff that we discussed today. Dr. David Bradford, thank you so much for joining us yet again on Well, Well, Well here on Joy in the Community Radio Network.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That has been another episode of Well, Well, Well. A big thank you to my guests this week. If you want to hear more from the series or catch up on previous episodes of Well, 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 head to the Joy website, www.joy.org.au/well-well-well. There you can also subscribe to the podcast as well as email us if you think there is something impacting the health and well-being of our communities that we should be talking about. I'll be back next week continuing our series in the lead up to World AIDS Day. Until next time, look after yourself and those around you. This is Well, Well, Well here on Joy and the Community Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to Well, 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 supported by Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network. For more LGBTIQ+ health and well-being and much more, check out Thorn Harbour on social media at Thorn Harbour or via the website thornharbour.org.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.